Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is The Promise of Tomorrow, where people in industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of The Promise of Tomorrow.
Today we're going to get right to our guest, Professor Adrian Bajan. The first half hour we're going to talk about constructual law, and the second half hour he's back with some surprising views as to why the American education system is the envy of the world. But now to our guest.
Stand by.
Okay, now to today's guest. We have with us Dr. Adrian Bajan. He's a professor at Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. Welcome to the program, Doctor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mason. I'm very happy to be included in your program.
So where did we find you? Are you in Cape Town?
Yes, I'm in Cape Town. Are you familiar with Cape Town?
No, I've never been there. I've traveled pretty much extensively overseas, but I've never been to Cape Town. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it's, I think, one of the three most gorgeous cities in the world, the other two being Hong Kong and Istanbul, endowed greatly with the geography and contrast, the heights and then the ocean. And there's a wharf area here which they've rebuilt, and it's a major, commercial activity, shops and stuff like that. And they built most recently this new stadium right in the middle of it. And the whole soccer scene is in the best place in the city, which is the best city in the world. to my huge surprise, the organization here is in fact phenomenal. I had doubts about the ability of this country to stage such a show, but I'm being proven wrong. So it's really a good atmosphere, and nobody has gotten drunk and out of control yet.
You go out to the stadium, but isn't the stadium in the middle of grinding poverty? Is the poverty real apparent there around the stadium? Is it a tough place to be?
In Cape Town, as I was saying just a second ago, they built it in the middle of the most affluent part of the city. I suspect in Cape Town and other places, it is the way you just said. And top of the world in the middle of lower than third world contrast is in fact one of the present-day features of South Africa. Extreme stratification in terms of wealth, and which of course was the feature during apartheid. The change of regime now almost 20 years ago did not do much. In other words, they really do not have a thriving middle class the way we have in the United States.
Yeah, you're talking about when Nelson Mandela got out of jail and then was elected president, I guess. That's what you're speaking
right,
about.
Right, and his party has been in power for almost 20 years. And obviously, that party has developed itself into an elite and hierarchy and in every respect. But at the bottom of the scale, you still see the favelas.
Do you have to wear earplugs to protect yourself from those horns that everybody is blowing all over Cape Town?
I confess, I feel like throwing fists. Those horns are not my cup of tea. I'm not a fan. But you know, it's the local habit, and so many of these foreign tourists have fallen for it, and I'm just trying to stay out of trouble. In fact, right before you called, I've closed the window of my hotel so that nobody will interfere with our transmission.
But the weather is probably cool down there, isn't it? Winter time where you are right at the moment?
It is winter, but the weather is gorgeous in Cape Town. In fact, geographically, this is the place that should be the coldest. But anyway, it's been wonderful here. Absolutely, no complaint. In American terms, you know, temperatures in the 70s, and only one rainy day in 8 days that we've been here.
We caught you at your hotel in Cape Town, South Africa. You're there for the World Cup soccer competition, and I trust you're nice and comfortable. And I would like to have you kind of explain the subject that we want to talk about today, constructual law and the books that you've written about that. Can you give us an explanation about what we're talking about here?
Well, the principle is a law of physics called the constructal law. It is the law of design evolution, design generation, and design evolution in nature. It is a universal principle that accounts for the fact or for the natural tendency of everything that flows and moves to continue to. to flow and move by configuring itself to flow more easily. The way to recognize first of all the idea, and the fact that the idea is known to everybody, is to think of the formation of a river basin under the persistent rain. The ground swells with water, channels form, the channels unite to create larger channels, and this configuration, which is famously shaped as a tree, not a tree in the orchard, but a tree on the map, continues to morph and continues to throb and to contort itself. The contorting never ends, but the direction of these changes, in other words, this movie of configurations, today's river basin followed by tomorrow's river basin, is oriented in such a way that the new configuration flows more easily than the preceding one. So this is now coming from physics, the principle of design and the principle of evolution from physics. In other words, not as a subchapter or section about biology, not as a special topic about the evolution of technology. It is about the design birth. And then evolution of everything that moves.
You introduced this idea of constructual law in 1996, and the idea for this, for any system, animate or inanimate, to persist in time, it must evolve to move with greater ease. So you're saying that all of evolution involves movement with greater ease. Is that the idea?
Correct, that's right. And that particular arrival of the idea was quite accidental, because I'm a professor of engineering. In fact, my specialty is thermodynamics. It is about it is the science of better and better machines. You know, how to make making better vehicles, which incidentally are about moving mass horizontally on the landscape more and more easily. This is the evolution of vehicle technology. And then if we understand that and we put it in the same let's say, in the same meal with the evolution of the river basins, which is also about making mass move horizontally on Earth more and more easily. It is not a long leap to think of animal mass evolving in time, obviously over millions and millions of years, in the same direction, which is to propel and to spread animal mass more and more easily on Earth. So animal life, not for the sake of one animals living, but animal life for evolution, for the sake of moving more and more animal mass on the landscape. Just like the water mass in the rivers, just like our stuff, human mass or our goods in our trucks all over the landscape. So it's all about design for the purpose of moving actually the global sphere, or mixing it, if you will, more and more easily, and to this give edge of moving things, you can add the the atmosphere with the wind patterns, those are other designs, and the hydrosphere with the currents of the oceans, which is another atlas of designs. So all this design in nature, quote unquote, is about the whole Earth configuring itself to flow and to mix itself, obviously on the horizontal, more and more easily.
Well, it's fascinating that an engineer would be led to this sort of nature and biology. And I understand your thesis has been adopted pretty widely now. The University of Oura in Portugal, the University of Toulouse in France, and a number of engineers are latching on to the things that you've said and are using it to improve things mechanically. How did an engineer get interested in biology and nature?
Well, I suppose we are all, each of us is educated broadly on the way to becoming engineer or physicist or economist or you name the field. So we possess a basis or a kind of a ticket to culture, and that stays in the pocket until the need arises. In my case, it was an accident. I thought I was doing very well in thermodynamics, in the science of energy systems, and then by accident I made this connection. The connection is actually very very simple to see. The whole world is animated, in fact, is curious, and this has been true for forever, curious about what goes on around us. Where do we come from? Why are these beautiful things all around? What is life? Big questions. So that is the world in which we live. And here I was, as an engineer, in fact, making a living at creating design. And doing this design work based on common sense, I know what better design is relative to the not so good. And then it occurred to me that the better design happens today relative to yesterday. In other words, there is a time arrow. There is a direction of time in the phenomenon of designing. And so this is where the two and two appear on the table, and then I put them together in this way, that the activity that goes on in engineering as a matter of common sense is completely analogous with what goes on all around us in nature. That's number one. Number two, the activity that goes on in engineering as a matter of common sense is not, or was not in 1996, supported or recommended by a law of physics. We are practicing design improvement in 1996 illegally, you see. So I then said, hey, if the law is missing, let me state it. And I stated, I stated in English, obviously, in very simple words from the street, not using a buzzword such as entropy. I stated what it means for a system to persist in time, and to persist in time means to live. The answer is it must flow in such a way that the future configuration permits flowing more easily than the present configuration. So the constructor law is about the direction in time of the evolution of the design generation phenomenon. All this, as I said, should be familiar. We, all of us, know it. We joke sometimes. Sometimes we recognize we've been defeated. But anyway, we say about we speak of the wisdom of going with the flow. We speak of you know, if you can't beat them, join them. We speak of seeking the shortest path or the path of least resistance. In economics, my colleagues speak of maximizing utility. One has to be careful. The constructor law is not about maximizing anything or minimizing or optimizing. The constructor law is a commandment. It is the statement that there is direction, that things should flow with configuration, and these configurations should change in a direction in time.
Well, then when you came to these realizations, then you and I understand you've been working on automobiles, is that what you said? A better transportation with cars and that sort of thing, and that the study of the wheel led you to understand that the wheel is something that is really inherent in all of nature and not something that was invented 3,500 years ago or whatever. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, the wheel story is the most recent example of how a new law of physics illuminates a body of knowledge that is actually quite voluminous and old. Before talking about the wheel, I make a more general observation. With the new law of physics, in this case the constructor law, it is possible, meaning for the person who has this law in his mind, it is possible to see a body of observations a lot more clearly, a lot more simply, faster, more directly. And so that's the way I feel when I run into colleagues who know a lot more than I do. And so at Duke University, I'm very fortunate to be running into colleagues who know lots of things more than I do, sociologists, biologists, economists, and so on, philosophers of science, all sorts of types. And they tell me many things. And one of the statements that I kept hearing now for several years from colleagues in biology is that nature makes mistakes. That's one comment. And along with my colleagues from the other universities you mentioned, we explained that in fact, based on the constructor law, which is of course obeyed by all of nature, just like the law of gravity and some other laws of thermodynamics, nature does not make mistakes. And what appears to be a mistake in zoology, for example, is simply the result of the researchers focusing on particular small thing, such as the design of the heart. The design of the heart appears to be poor because the heart has small chambers, it has small blood vessels. These smaller things, the flow passages are constrictive to the flow. There's too much friction in the heart, you see, and the body has to work really hard in order to pump. That is the wrong approach or the wrong view, the myopic view. The constructive view is to think of the heart as one component, say one pump on a truck, and the truck is the whole animal body, and the object of the design is to move the body more and more easily on earth. And then the question is, how should this body be designed so that it moves more easily, meaning with less and less food, to greater distances? And the answer to that question is that the body should be made of organs that are, on the one hand, big enough not to be constrictive, but on the other hand, small enough to be light as suitcases to be carried, you see. Mm-hmm. And from this trade-off emerge all the right sizes of heart, brain, kidney, and all these other things that, make the complex flow system that is the animal itself, or the truck, for that matter, on the highway. The truck on the highway would be obviously more efficient if it had the bigger engines, but that is not a good way in which to carry weight on the truck. And so the punchline to this introductory example is that knowing too much tends to focus the scientists on things that are too narrow. With the law of physics, we enjoy a bird's eye view of nature, and the example with the nature makes mistakes. I have many examples of this type. The story of the wheel is the most recent. Colleagues, in fact, very famous biologists, have written. In fact, have made news all over by declaring that. Nature invented lots of things, but nature did not invent the wheel. Today's news is that that happens to be wrong. Nature invented, yes, everything, including the wheel.
I'm fascinated by it too, with nature inventing the wheel. How did nature invent the wheel? Please drill down for me on that.
Okay, well, there are two ways in which to see the image, because it is a mental image, you know, how this thing happened. First, the easiest is to think of the human wheel and how it has been evolving in time. The human wheel began a few thousand years ago as a solid disc with a hole in the middle. Mm-hmm. And with the axle passing through the hole. A few centuries after that, the Egyptians discovered that this moving of mass, transportation is easier if the wheel is lighter. This is now the wheel, a lighter suitcase on the vehicle that the wheel helps. And so the wheel with spokes arrived. This wheel with spokes has become better and better. You can imagine the fancy carriages that preceded the inventing of the automobile. Lighter wheels with fewer spokes. Today, if you look at the winning motorcycles, they have three spokes, meaning the lightest imaginable wheels with a rim. Well, I made a drawing of this, the evolution of the human wheel, which points in a very clear direction, which means fewer spokes, mm-hmm. lighter wheel. What is the wheel that's even better than the wheel with three spokes? Well, the wheel with two spokes, okay? That's one way in which to arrive at the walking animal.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be right back. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today? Louis L'Amour. Adventure? Just a romantic name for trouble.